From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. Activists for and against abortion rights are massing outside of the Supreme Court following the High Court's 6-3 decision this morning to strike down nearly 50 years of the constitutional right to end a pregnancy. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Today, the Republican-controlled Supreme Court has achieved their dark, extreme goal of ripping away a woman's right to make their own reproductive health decisions. Because of Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, and the Republican Party, their supermajority in the Supreme Court, American women today have less freedom than their mothers.
Let's go to NPR's Sarah McCammon. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Celeste.
It's incorrect to describe this as a ban on abortion. Instead, it's an end to federal protection of abortion rights. What does that mean?
That's right, Celeste. It means that states now have tremendous latitude to restrict or ban abortion really throughout pregnancy. What Roe v. Wade and subsequent Supreme Court precedents that sort of refined it and supported it had done was to prohibit states from banning abortion, particularly earlier in pregnancy. The thinking was that as a fetus moved toward viability, the state had more of an interest in regulating abortion. But earlier on, you know, a woman had a right to seek an abortion that a state really couldn't interfere with very much at all. So now states essentially get to decide what the policy is. They can ban abortion altogether. And, you know, as we speak, Celeste, I'm seeing reports and also hearing from clinic personnel that I have talked to around the country of clinics shutting down as many states put into effect laws that they already had on the books ready to go for just this situation.
This is what's often referred to as these trigger laws. Can you explain in more detail? Give me an example of what some of these laws now in place do.
Right. Well, according to the Center for Reproductive Rights and the Guttmacher Institute, which are both organizations that support abortion rights and have done a lot of really deep analysis of these state laws, something like 13 states were expected to today, essentially, or very quickly in the next 30 days, prohibit abortion. So, for example, Kentucky and Louisiana and South Dakota all have laws on the books that explicitly ban abortion virtually, I think, throughout pregnancy, maybe with a couple of exceptions. I'd have to double check. But as soon as Roe v. Wade is overturned, and of course the court explicitly said that it was overturned. So those states, you know, I'm already hearing from providers in those states who were immediately shutting down services. There's another tier of states like Texas, for example, that has a 30-day pause, essentially, after Roe is overturned in its state law. However, Texas, like many other states, also has an old pre-Roe v. Wade law on the books. So one clinic I spoke to this morning said they had stopped providing services because they're not sure which law is in effect. And this is something that legal analysts have been predicting, Celeste, that as soon as this decision came down, there would be a lot of uncertainty and a lot of sort of trying to parse what it means and which laws are in effect. But the bottom line is that these organizations have predicted that something like half the country is likely to quickly prohibit most or all abortions. And by quickly, I mean within days or weeks.
And for there are some states, I have to assume, that are already moving to protect abortion rights because of this decision as well, correct?
That's true. We have seen efforts in, for example, in Michigan. The governor there is a Democrat, and she took steps to try to block in court an old pre-Roe abortion ban. That law from 1931 was blocked by a court, although that's still being litigated, so there's some uncertainty there. And then you have states like Illinois, which I just visited within the past couple of weeks, where the governor and the legislature have been working to remove old restrictions and sort of clarify protections for abortion rights. There you have, for example, a large Planned Parenthood clinic in southeastern Illinois, just across the state line from Missouri, from the St. Louis area, that opened up a couple of years ago and has been really preparing for this moment, in part because Missouri has, for years, had very restrictive abortion laws that made it very difficult for patients to get an abortion. And now in this moment, Missouri has a trigger law, so abortion is completely illegal now there. And so states like Illinois have been preparing, you know, and working to take in more patients from out of state.
Yeah. Sarah McCammon covers reproductive rights for NPR. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Catherine Colbert, a longtime women's rights attorney. She argued the Supreme Court case Planned Parenthood versus Casey in the 1990s that reaffirmed Roe. That was overruled today. Catherine, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. While I'm happy to talk with you, it's a very, very difficult day.
I understand, and this gets to my first question. I was going to ask you, what's your reaction to today's news, and what does this mean for women across the U.S. in your view?
Well, it's an extraordinarily radical opinion. We got a taste of it when the Alito draft was issued, but today's ruling goes even further. And I think at the heart of it, the federal constitutional right to make decisions about whether, when, with whom, and how you have children has been removed. And as your reporter just told us, about 25 states will ban abortion either altogether or to such an extent that it will be nearly impossible to obtain in over half of our country. And geographically, that means from about, the east coast of Georgia to the west coast of Oklahoma, north from the Canadian border down through the mountain states to the Mexican border, all of those locations will ban abortion, and women's lives and health will both be severely undermined and restricted, and the important ability to make decisions about one's life has been eviscerated.
Right. So as this procedure becomes illegal in a large part of the country, what are your biggest concerns? I mean, among the concerns, do you have concerns that we're going to return to a time when women had to resort to horrific, dangerous methods to end a pregnancy? Is that chief among your concerns?
Well, some women will. And it won't just be women who need abortion. It will be women who are carrying pregnancies that have problems. So they will be affected as well as, you know, for a woman carrying an ectopic pregnancy, for example, or a woman who has a pregnancy with severe fetal anomalies, they will be denied medical care as much as the woman early in pregnancy who chooses to terminate it. I think that there's two parts that I'm most concerned with. First of all, thankfully, unlike the days before Roe, where back alley abortions were most common, today there is the advent of medication abortion. And I think women in the states where abortion is banned, and including medication abortion is banned, will turn to seeking care in other states, traveling hundreds of miles to do so, or seeking medication abortion through the gray or the black market. I'm worried for two reasons. One, I'm worried about those women who have difficulties using the drug. It's really safe. It's a very effective method of doing abortions. But some of those women may seek care from a local hospital and subject themselves to criminal prosecution in their state. And people who help those women may be subjected to criminal prosecution. And second, and I think this is really important, I don't think that one's ability to obtain medical care ought to depend on where you live, what race you are, who you love, the pronouns that you use, anything other than the fact that you decide that this is best for you. And it seems really, really problematic that this ultra-conservative court has taken that right away from women.
Well, Catherine Colbert, I want to come back to the opinion by Justice Samuel Alito that you made reference to. He said, quote, "It's time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives." He also wrote, "We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. The Constitution makes no reference to abortion. No such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provision." Respond to that part of his decision.
Well, first of all, women weren't mentioned in the original Constitution. Remember, we didn't even get the right to vote till the 1920s. So I don't think that whether a right is explicitly contained in the Constitution ought to be the standard. For example, the right to use contraception, to marry a person of one's choice, regardless of their race or their gender, is not explicit in the Constitution. What the Constitution does is it uses language like liberty and equality and due process to enable courts to determine what interests are fundamental to one's life, what are most important to be protected against incursions by overreaching government. And, you know, what we learned about abortion early on is that state legislators used politics and played politics with women's lives. That's not okay, is my view. It's time that we, change those legislators because, frankly, that's the only recourse we now have.
All right. Well, that's Catherine Colbert. She's a longtime women's rights attorney. She argued the Supreme Court case Planned Parenthood versus Casey in the 1990s. Catherine Colbert, thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We learned more in the January 6th committee hearing yesterday about just how far former President Trump went to push his lies about election fraud and his effort to upend the peaceful transfer of power. It went all the way to the top of the U.S. Department of Justice. We learned how Trump tried to enlist top officials to push his agenda, how he tried to replace the U.S. Attorney General with someone who would go along with him. It was another moment that reminded many of the Watergate hearings 50 years ago, which ultimately brought down President Nixon. Back then, testimony from John Dean, who was the White House counsel to Nixon, riveted the nation. And John Dean joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Anthony.
What struck you most about what you heard yesterday?
I have never seen a hearing in the United States Congress that was as devastating for any president at any time as the hearing yesterday.
Wow. What stuck out to you?
It showed a president who is trying to take a wrecking ball to the Department of Justice and some career seasoned lawyers, very able, came back and just were really powerful witnesses against the president and his behavior.
You know, you witnessed the so-called Saturday night massacre when Nixon fired Watergate investigators and the U.S. Attorney General resigned. That moment was very important in turning the tide of public opinion against Nixon. So yesterday, as you suggest, we heard how Trump came very close to triggering a similar constitutional crisis. He wanted to replace Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen with someone sympathetic to his false claims about election fraud. Can you compare the public response to that event 50 years ago to what we're witnessing today? Do you think the public is going to respond the same way?
This didn't provoke that kind of reaction, and this had been foreshadowed. Several newspapers had told this story in a very accurate way, but not with the drama of the witnesses actually laying it out in front of the country.
Right, right. So how concerned are you about that? I mean, the fact that this doesn't seem to be getting the kind of reaction that we witnessed 50 years ago.
Well, I'm not sure that the committee is not getting the kind of reaction we got from 50 years ago. I think this committee is far more sophisticated than the Senate Watergate Committee proceedings. They ground on until they got to my hearings, and then they went to all the networks. Happened to cover mine because there was a little bit of drama had to build up.
There's an understatement, John Dean. So let me ask you about your hearings. When you testified during Watergate, it riveted the nation. I was quite young then, but even I remember that. You were a former White House lawyer, and you revealed that the President of the United States was lying, had participated in a cover-up of the Watergate scandal. It was a stunning moment. Have we had a John Dean moment in these January 6th hearings? And if so, what was it?
I think you've had some bits and pieces. I noticed that Cassidy Hutchinson, I believe her name is, yesterday was on camera revealing members of Congress who'd sought pardons at the very end of the hearing. They didn't build that up, but it was pretty revelatory. But just those witnesses, the three senior able lawyers, just being able to respond and lay out what had gone on and how unusual it was and unprecedented to just take the head off the top of the Department of Justice and had Trump, you know, really carried through, he probably would have lost many U.S. attorneys and more probably would have walked out.
Right. It would have been a sort of another, it would have been similar to the Saturday Night Massacre.
It would have been the Saturday Night Massacre times 100.
Wow. Wow. You have said that if Trump is not indicted, the country is in trouble. And I want to ask you about that because federal prosecutors have to weigh the idea of indicting Trump against the precedent that it would set if a current administration prosecutes a previous president. Historically, the closest we ever came to this was Watergate, but President Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon in the name of sort of closure, I guess. What do you see happening today? Make a case for prosecuting Trump.
Well, we've never had a president engage in consistent and persistent criminal behavior. Donald Trump has zero respect for the rule of law. He demonstrates it not only before he was president, during his presidency, and since his presidency. But it's his presidency we're focused on. And these are pretty serious crimes. I mean, they are not defrauding the American public is a serious crime. Defrauding the Congress is a serious crime. They have hefty sentences. And he's also done it at the state level. I happen to think that Fannie Willis is going to move first. Fannie Willis is the district attorney of Fulton County. Mm-hmm. She's a black woman, an experienced prosecutor. She's had an expert on RICO law, state RICO law, and Georgia has a dandy statute, a very tough statute. And I think she's going to move first, and I think she's going to move before the end of the month. And that's going to break the dam about, well, there's something sacrosanct about being a former president. You can't touch him. And there just shouldn't be.
The case that you're specifically talking about is that infamous phone call where President Trump tried to ask for Georgia election officials to find him the votes to essentially deliver the victory.
That is correct.
Right.
That is part of the case.
Yeah.
It is the case is far broader. He talked to other people. He sent people down to try to influence the Georgia election. He really leaned on Georgia of all the states where he tried to turn the vote. That was where he focused a lot of his attention. She's got a very powerful case. So we'll see. And that will end the precedent that former presidents can't be indicted.
I want to ask you one last question. You have said the truth is your ally. If you have the truth, you have a partner. But there's a challenge around this, and that is today a third of the country believes a lot of things that are not true. Polls show that a majority of Republicans believe the big lie about the election. You've written about this. What do we do about it?
Yeah, I was fascinated by these personalities. I first encountered them at the Nixon White House, who click their heels, salute, and go do whatever the president says, and then believe in the president. Today, some of my former colleagues believe deeply that Nixon was railroaded, that he did nothing wrong, and they want to believe that he never was involved in the cover-up. And so, but Trump made it okay to be an authoritarian, and now we have a whole party that is looking and grasping authoritarian. And I got to tell you, authoritarianism and democracy do not work well together.
Yeah, that's clear. Final question, John Dean. I think one of the big lessons that Watergate taught us 50 years ago, presidents can be corrupt. And the media plays a big role in holding presidents' feet to the fire. 50 years later, as we're watching these hearings, what's the big lesson we're learning here, do you think?
one of the lessons is that presidents sometimes can't be held responsible. If we do not hold Trump accountable, presidents are above the law. It's just that simple. Mm. As some people have said, you know, you're damned if you indict him, you're damned if you don't indict him. It's a very tough choice. But for the future of democracy, I don't think there's any question that Merrick Garland has got to indict this man and hold him responsible and accountable.
All right. Well, that's John Dean. He served as White House counsel to President Richard Nixon and testified against him in the Watergate hearings 50 years ago. John Dean, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
President Biden called it a sad day for the court and the country after the U.S. Supreme Court released its ruling this morning to overturn Roe v. Wade. The 1973 decision protected legal access to abortion across the country, but no longer. Several states have already enacted abortion bans, and the procedure could be banned in about half the country in short order. Other states are moving to shore up abortion rights. NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow joins us now. Scott, good to have you.
Hey, good afternoon.
So you've covered the president as he ran for office and as he's dealt with this issue during his time in the White House. What struck you about what the president had to say today?
You know, a few things. One, I was struck by how willing Biden was to repeatedly say that this is an extreme ruling by an extreme Supreme Court. That's how he framed it. This is a longtime institutionalist, longtime chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee making that point as he talked about this ruling. You know, Biden talked about steps that his administration will take going forward, but also effectively conceded that they're limited and said, look, the votes are not there in Congress right now, despite the fact that Democrats control both the House and the Senate, to codify the abortion rights that Roe v. Wade had given. And Biden made this pitch to voters who support abortion rights to say, you need to show up at the polls, you need to make this the central issues of a campaign. But he said that in a context where so many of the big factors that usually decide elections, including the economy, are really pointing against the Democratic Party right now. And when Biden has, you know, low 40s, high 30s approval rating, it's really a condition where Democrats would lose, not gain seats this fall.
Right. So as you mentioned, I mean, the president said it's up to Congress to restore the rights that were enshrined in Roe v. Wade. That's obviously not going to happen, at least not in this Congress at this time. So what, if anything, can the president do now in terms of executive action, for example?
Biden said the federal government would do a few things, that it would ensure that women are allowed to cross state borders to get abortions, that doctors who treat women from other states would not be punished. We're not sure exactly what that would look like, whether that's, you know, legal actions or anything else. He also said that the federal government will ensure that FDA-approved pills are able to be sent through the mail. He's talking there about pills that end pregnancies that are going to become a big focal point of where policy goes next. Merrick Garland, the attorney general, said that the Department of Justice would work to ensure that. Health and Human Services Secretary Becerra said something similar. But look, big picture, executive actions, federal actions cannot stop the basic trend line of Republican legislatures passing state-level laws, which is where most of the action is here.
Right. So, as we know, Biden has been struggling in the polls. Democrats are expecting to lose the House, possibly the Senate, in November. Mm-hmm. They have been expecting that. Does this ruling change the political calculus at all for Democrats, or even the political atmosphere?
You know, usually predictions to that end are wrong far from the election.
Yeah.
But I think—
Fair enough.
You know, there are so many implications from today's ruling that directly affect people's lives in ways that many people will be happy about, in ways that many people will be upset about. I think this is something that's not going to fade away like many other policies we asked that question about, right? Going forward, I mean, we've spent so much time today covering the amount of states that have instantly put new laws on the books or enacted old laws that immediately make abortion illegal. I think this will be something we'll be talking about for months.
Scott Detrow, NPR White House correspondent, thanks so much.
Sure thing. Thank you.
We're covering the Supreme Court's decision today that overturns Roe v. Wade. The new ruling says Americans do not have the constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy, that that right is not protected across the country. The decision will have a profound and, in some cases, immediate impact on tens of millions of people. Let's turn now to O. Carter Sneed. He's a law professor at Notre Dame who filed an amicus brief in support of Mississippi overturning Roe v. Wade. Good to have you, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
So what's your reaction to the Supreme Court's ruling today?
Well, I think like most people who are following it closely, it's not that surprising given the leak from earlier in May, which itself was quite surprising, which has not really happened in quite that way, as far as I can tell. It's essentially the same argument that Justice Alito made. The opinion is unchanged from the original version in all material parts, and it basically says that if you consider the history and tradition and text of the Constitution and whether or not a particular proposed right is deeply and firmly rooted in that tradition, taking into account all of American history, it's clear that the right to abortion is, in fact, such a deeply rooted right, and therefore the American people, through the democratically elected representatives, should resolve the question of abortion law and policy as was the case before 1973, and as is the case in most countries around the world, where this is resolved through the political process and not by judges.
Right. So let me ask you about the sort of constitutional basis for this. Justice Alito wrote that Roe had to be overruled, and he wrote, "The Constitution makes no reference to abortion, and no such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provision." That's what you just suggested. But critics of the decision point out that the Constitution makes no reference to women's rights, to the rights of Black people, to a number of other rights that we have since embraced. So can you respond to that criticism around Alito's thinking?
Course. Yeah, and it's an understandable criticism. I don't read Justice Alito's opinion to freeze in amber the rights that were present in 1868 when we had a long ago in terms of equality for men and women and persons of color. And I don't read the opinion describing the analytic framework in exactly that way. The question is, what questions are reserved for the political process and which questions are the province of the justices? And only those rights that are not merely not mentioned in the Constitution, but also not present in the history of our republic. At no point at common law, or certainly not in the 19th century, was there a right to abortion. Quite the contrary, it was criminalized. It was legally disfavored. And if you compare that to rights like other rights like same-sex marriage or contraception or interracial marriage, those are rights that are certainly in the heartland or adjacent to long protected rights to marital intimacy, rights to marriage. And then also Justice Alito makes the distinction, the important distinction that I think a lot of critics underplay, which is abortion is different in that it actually involves the intentional killing of a third being. Disagreement about the moral status of that being, but it is a living human organism, a member of the human species. And that's what distinguishes the context of abortion. And therefore, this vexed question is not the same thing as fundamental questions of equality for women and minorities and others in the way that you describe. This is a question that's reserved and left to the political process, unlike those matters, because Justice Alito doesn't dispense entirely with the concept of what he calls substantive due process. He does admit the possibility of rights that are not specifically mentioned being vindicated against the state action, but he says that abortion is not one of those rights.
Right. Professor, you've also said that you believe the issue of abortion has been damaging to the Supreme Court, and I'm curious if you believe if this ruling could be more potentially damaging to the court because of those who view it as being politically motivated. I mean, if you look at polling, Americans' confidence in the court has dropped to an historic low at a time when most Americans say that access to abortion should be protected.
Yeah, so I think public opinion surveys are tricky. Most people agree, and you're right, that most people surveyed say they want Roe v. Wade to remain the law of the land, but the very same people, by wide margins, support restrictions on abortion that Roe wouldn't permit. Most people support restrictions on abortion after the first trimester, and support restrictions on late-term abortion, neither of which Roe or Casey would have countenanced. So I think that, I think that the court's integrity is at its apex when it acts as a court, when it doesn't try to do politics, but simply says, "What's the question? The question is, what does the Constitution mean? Not just Constitution mean, not merely in light of its text, but also its history and tradition." And I think if you take examples like Brown versus Board of Education, that's a moment where the court acted in a way that provoked enormous political controversy.
Professor,
entire systems
Yeah, I'm going to have to jump in and stop you. I'm sorry. The clock is ticking down, but it's been great having you, Professor O. Carter Sneed from the University of Notre Dame
Law School. Thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. Well, we appreciate having you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Let's bring in UC Davis Law Professor Mary Ziegler now. Her recent book is Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Professor Ziegler, Mary, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So it has been nearly 50 years, two entire generations since Roe v. Wade gave women control of their own reproductive health. What does this ruling mean? In other words, there are people who might get pregnant in half of the country whose rights have now fundamentally changed.
Right. They don't have rights anymore. That's what happened. And we don't know what will happen beyond that, because one of the things, of course, that we know is that historically the anti-abortion movement was very unified, had a very clear kind of hierarchy or structure of command. That isn't true anymore. In the same way, so it's very difficult to predict how far states will go in surveying people to determine if they're having abortions. And in the kind of universe of people they may seek to punish or the kinds of punishments they may seek to impose. We know kind of what the starting point is. We don't know where we're going.
So we're not just talking about surgical abortions. We're not just talking about abortions that occur when someone goes into a clinic. But in some states, they've also included restrictions or even outright bans on things like the morning after pill and medication abortions. What are options for someone who is pregnant to get medication now by mail, either from the U.S. or perhaps from other countries?
Well, there are options to do that. Of course, it's not clearly legal to do that, right? I mean, the question, of course, for someone in those states will be, you know, what would happen if they violate the law in their own state? The answer may depend. They're not likely to go to prison. There are no red states at the moment that are announcing an intention to punish pregnant people for ending their pregnancies. That could change. That doesn't mean, though, that people wouldn't face surveillance and other pretty unpleasant things if they try to end their own pregnancies in red states. They could try to travel out of state. But I mean, if I were telling you that I was sure that I knew what would happen next, when people do that, I would be lying. I think that this is unprecedented in more ways than one. And so for people in those states, what the future is going to look like is very hard to anticipate.
Well, let me push the boundaries of what you know and don't know just a little further and talk
Absolutely.
About enforcement. There are some states that intend to ban abortion at such an early period that you may not know that you're pregnant as early as 6 weeks.
States planning on banning abortion at fertilization. So there will be people who are absolutely not, you know, there's no abortion full stop whenever at any point.
Does that raise concerns for you about how that might be enforced?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that in order for states to enforce these laws, they might have to undertake pretty sweeping digital surveillance, not just, of course, of people who are seeking abortions, but people of reproductive age, people who are pregnant. We don't know if the mail will come into play. Of course, there are limits on when law enforcement can open your mail. We don't know if medical professionals will be enlisted in reporting people who are suspected of having abortions. Don't know if states are going to institute kind of bounty programs like Texas has, but the possibilities are obviously pretty sweeping.
There was also a mention in Justice Thomas's concurring opinion about reconsidering the right to contraception. Are you concerned that things like birth control pills and IUDs might end up falling under some of these restrictions?
Absolutely. I mean, to your earlier question, some common contraceptives are viewed by some religious employers and others as abortion-inducing drugs. So without the court directly confronting the question of contraception, some contraceptives may become inaccessible. But we also know that Justice Thomas is saying we have to go further and directly overrule other rights.
UC Davis Law Professor Mary Ziegler. Professor Ziegler, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made this comment this morning about today's Supreme Court ruling striking down abortion rights and yesterday's decision by the High Court to overturn New York's restrictions on concealed carry permits.
It's such a contradiction. Yesterday, the states cannot make laws governing the constitutional right to bear arms. And today, they're saying the exact reverse, that the states can overturn a constitutional right for 50 years, a constitutional right for a woman having the right to choose. The hypocrisy is raging, but the harm is endless.
Let's bring in NBC senior national political reporter Sahil Kapoor to discuss that and other major developments that happened in Washington this week. Hi there.
Hi, great to be back.
It's good to have you. Democrats predict that Republicans will pay a high price for striking down abortion rights when midterm elections happen in November. Do you think that's true?
Well, that is certainly the goal of Democrats right now, is to channel this backlash, this rage and this fury at the Supreme Court's decision toward the ballot box. The simple reason is that they don't have the votes in Congress right now to codify the right to an abortion. There is a bill written by Democrats that has passed the House of Representatives, but it is stranded in the Senate. It needs 60 votes to defeat a filibuster, and it does not have anywhere close to that. So the best Democrats can do at this moment in trying to channel the anger of voters is to encourage them to show up in the midterm elections in races for Congress and state houses and for governor, and to elect Democratic candidates who they say would protect legal abortion, and while arguing that Republican candidates up and down the ballot would vote to outlaw or criminalize abortion. Some of them have said as much already, although other Republicans are downplaying the possibility of something like a nationwide abortion ban. That's key to remember. There's a lot of talk about how the Supreme Court decision simply sends the question of legal abortion back to states. It also sends it back to Congress, which can either protect abortion nationwide or outlaw it.
I wonder if you think this ruling against abortion rights will be the lasting legacy of the Trump administration. I mean, after all, it was his three appointees to the court voting in the majority that really turned the balance on Roe v. Wade.
Without a doubt, this is one of the most significant legacies of former President Trump. He campaigned explicitly in the closing weeks of the 2016 election, saying he would pick judges if elected president who would overturn Roe versus Wade. In his words, it would happen automatically if he put two or three new justices onto the Supreme Court. Well, he did exactly that, and they did exactly that. This is something that the conservative movement has fought for decades, and they finally achieved it. And now the question is, in the political arena, will there be a different kind of reaction? The hope among Democrats is that many voters who had kind of been complacent about this issue. They had taken for granted the fact that Roe versus Wade had been on the book for about half a century, that they thought it would never go away. And now the fact that it has gone away, the hope among Democrats is that it'll wake people up. They do have public polling on their side. Our NBC News poll taken last month found that 60% of Americans want abortion to be legal in all or most cases, while just 37% want it to be illegal in all or most cases. It remains to be seen whether this political benefit for Democrats actually materializes, because we are in uncharted waters here.
Well, speaking of the legacy of the Trump administration, we are in the midst of hearings about January 6th in the committee that's investigating that. Yesterday, we heard Acting Deputy General Attorney General Richard Donahue describe what Trump told him that he wanted him to do about the presidential election.
What I'm just asking you to do is just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman.
Is it possible we will see a criminal trial for the first time of a former president?
You know, that is entirely in the hands of the Justice Department right now. Attorney General Merrick Garland has been somewhat muted on that question. He has only said broadly that the Department of Justice will pursue accountability for all individuals involved in January 6th, no matter who they are, no matter how high up in political spaces they were. But the January 6th committee knows that it is not a prosecutorial body. It is a legislative committee, and their goal is a couple of things: to tell a full and complete story of what happened on the day of January 6th, everything that led up to it. One source on that who's familiar with the committee's work, described it to me as a fire that had been kindling for months and months, and they want to tell the story of who did the kindling and who lit the match. What we saw at this most recent hearing was the pressure that then-President Trump put on the Justice Department when he was still president in the closing weeks of his presidency after he had lost the election, the pressure he had put on the Justice Department to promote his lies that the election was stolen, so he could then use that to overturn the result.
Yeah.
You heard officials like Richard Donahue and others talk about how these were all conspiracy theories that Trump was told repeatedly that there was no validity to them, and they kind of outlined his plot and the efforts of others, like another Justice Department official, Jeffrey Clark.
And we'll have to leave it there. That's Sahil Kapoor, senior national political reporter for NBC News. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston. It's Here and Now.